Hello, and welcome to the penultimate night of Millennial 2020. I have four streams tonight, as usual, and in 2 hours from now, it'll be John Bruce Leonard, then Luke Smith, and then finally Antidem. But first off, it's the Jolly Heretic, Dr. Edward Dutton. So, Ed, welcome to Millennial.
Hello, thank you for having me again. How's it going?
It's going quite well so far. As I say, we've only got two nights left. One night after this. So Millennial 2020 seems to have been a great success. I'm very glad to see. So anyway, what kind of year have you had?
What kind of year have I had?
Before we go into the main topic.
What's been going on this year? So I was working for a lot of the year on a book on a number of books. The end of last year, I got onto the radar of Hope Not Hate. That was good fun. So I was in their magazine, whatever their thing about YouTube people.
Yeah, annual Taste of Hate report.
Chucked off PayPal and things like this. And then I carried on with my YouTube channel, and then my colleague Michael Woodley of Manee, for various reasons, left the YouTube channel halfway through the year. So I had to rebuild it, which at first I was quite frightened about, and it sort of was a bit of a kick in the nuts, really. But then I seem to have managed to do that, so I was quite pleased about that. I kept that going and whatever. And then I've been working on a number of books. One's called Making Sense of Race, which was published at a few weeks ago, and then I'm working on a book at the moment called Witches, Feminism and the Fall of the West, which looks at how our society is increasingly dominated by literal witches. And then I'm working on a book on the future of civilization in terms of breeding patterns for political views. And then I'm working on a book about the future of Christianity. And then I've done various papers on various topics, intelligence and religion and intelligence and things like this. And then otherwise there was I was made professor. I was recognized. I was made full professor of evolutionary psychology at Asperger University in Poland, despite all the, evil.
Congratulations on that.
And then what else has gone on? And then that's it. And then one thing I got back into the other day was couldn't work out what to buy my son for Christmas. And so I got him a WWE wrestling game for the PlayStation. And I'd completely forgotten about how brilliant WWF was. And then I found out about all this skullduggery behind the scenes and all this stuff, which I've been watching documentaries about. And then I noticed that the wokeness of wrestling. So now the wrestlers have gone from being big, beefy guys that they were in the early 90s to people that like, I don't take steroids because I'm too moral. I'm a moral woke wrestler. This is what's going on now. So even that's fallen to wokeness, and lots of women wrestlers and stuff like that as well. So even that's gone. Even they've even taken hold of WWF, which is very sad. So yes, that's been my year. What about yours?
Oh, it's been a not quite as productive as your year from the sounds of it. But yeah, I mean, most people have talked about the BLM, COVID and lockdown and the US election. But obviously, you and I have a different topic that we're going to discuss. It's to do with the book that you've got coming out next year about witches, transsexualism and feminism.
That's so right. Witches, feminism and the fall of the West.
And the fall of the West. Okay. So first of all, could you get us into this topic by discussing the archetype or the figure of the witch?
Yeah, so I got thinking about it. There was a comment, actually, that was made by Robin Riley, who I think you interviewed. And it was that comment that inspired it, that she was confronted with these purple-headed dragons or something. And she said, oh, could we start burning witches again? And I thought, that's interesting. What are the kind of people that were witches in pre-modern England? I mean, the height of the witch craze was the 17th century. And what were the kind of people that are witches now? What was going on? What's the dynamic of the witch? What does the witch actually do? What's her function? Why did they want to kill them? Are we supposed to believe the narrative that it's still, they were just unpleasant? They were just picked on or whatever? Or is there something more to it? And the more you look into it, there is, what you've got is a system in evolutionary terms, of, as I discussed when I was on here last year, you can pass on your genes directly by having children. You can pass them on kin selection by having looking after your nephews and nieces, and you can pass them on by elevating your inclusive fitness, that is, your extended kinship group, your ethnic group. And once that happens, then, well, certainly with the aristocracy of these two groups fighting, you get into a situation of group selection, of two groups fighting each other to win out. And then if you look at the qualities which ensure that you dominate, that you win in the battle of group selection, and computer modelling has looked at those, these are high positive and negative ethnocentrism. High positive ethnocentrism is internal cooperation. High negative ethnocentrism, external violence. So those are the groups that dominate. So what the group is going to be selected to do is to optimise its group fitness by ensuring its ethnocentrism. How does it do this? Well, one of the things it does is it brings in religion, and it has the religion, and the religion makes adaptive things, i.e. positive and negative ethnocentrism, into the will of God. But another thing it needs to do is it needs to ensure there isn't much conflict. You need cooperation. So you can't have intermale conflict. Intermale conflict is a bad thing. Now, certainly in a lot of societies, you get into these weak societies that are under weak levels of selection pressure, like in Africa or whatever. There's massive intermale conflict because there's polygamy, and so all of the women want to go for the high status males, and so you get, in the case of the Bushmen, about 60% of the male population don't breed, and what those men spend their time doing is fighting and whatever, and so there's very little in the way of cooperation. It's not good for the group. So how you have to reduce intermale conflict? How do you reduce intermale conflict? You create patriarchy. And there was a fascinating paper which looked at this, that was in the Mankind Quarterly. You create patriarchy. What patriarchy does, it means that the male has control over the female. He controls her sexuality. She is controlled by him, whatever means it is, whether it's foot binding or veiling or whatever, but he controls her sexuality. So she is not independent of him. And that's patriarchy. And therefore, the patriarchy helps to ensure that the group is more positively and negatively ethnocentric. And therefore, the patriarchy becomes part of the religiousness and becomes the will of God and is promoted as the will of God. So that's it. And the witches deviate from this. And if you look at the kind of people that were accused of being witches everywhere, men are a slight exception that I look at separately in the book. But if you look at the kind of, basically, the men that are accused of being witches are antisocial men. So they're damaging to group selection. Group selection is about cooperation. They're antisocial men. So they get accused of witchcraft, deeply unpopular, antisocial types. It's mostly women, because what these women are doing is inadvertently questioning the patriarchy. They do that in a number of ways. One, they work as prostitutes. They work as financially independent women, which is showing other women that they can operate outside the patriarchy, and which is also undermining the system of sexual ethics and whatever. So prostitutes were accused of being witches. Two, they're sexually loose. You know, they have illegitimate children, things like this. Again, they're not conforming to the patriarchy. They should never be alone with a man. They're not conforming to the patriarchy. Thirdly, they are independent women. They're widows that have money and are independent, or they're spinsters and they never marry. And so they operate as independent women. Fourthly, they are antisocial women who, in a context of literal belief in witchcraft, do. You actually believe it. They're basically operating a separate religion of folk magic, which is therefore a rival to the patriarchal system. And so some of these people would genuinely believe that they were witches, and they would genuinely believe they had magic powers, and they would confess to it and whatever. And so in all of these ways, you can see that from an evolutionary perspective, what these witches were people that were undermining the patriarchy. And that's why they had to be at times of intense selection. And that's what the 17th century was. It was bloody cold. There was very intense group selection. And so you can see how, therefore, the group is under harsh selection for religiousness. And it becomes so religious that gradually across the 16th and 17th century, they start persecuting witches, particularly in your native Scotland. That was where it was very, very intense. James VI of Scotland, first of England, wrote a book on this, which I quote extensively in my own book. He said, witches are real. And I agree with him. And this is basically what you have. This is the nature of the witch. It is the person that undermines the patriarchal system, and in a system of harsh group selection, it is adaptive to remove those people from the population because they will spread negative social epistasis. They will spread thing. They will spread behaviour which undermines the group's inclusive fitness, and so therefore they had to be removed. Or they had to be stopped, and that's what you get. And you get it more intensely the more harsh the group selection. So it's much harsher in the north. In the north of Europe than in the south of Europe, and so yeah, that's basically the essence of it.
I can imagine a feminist hearing this and being feeling quite vindicated that witchcraft, the demonizing of certain women, was all an attempt by men to stay in power and maintain their power structure. And you seem to be saying that yes, that's exactly what it was.
Well, there's slightly more to it than that. So this is the nature of these witches. And so what you have is a society which is adapted towards patriarchy. If you are a female and you are patriarchal, you will signal that you are patriarchal. You will signal that you are religious. This is why one of the reasons why women are more religious than men. Men will want religiousness because it will be a sign. If the woman is saying, in order to have sex with me, you have to invest, then they want evidence that he's not just, the man wants evidence that she's not going to cuckold him. What is the evidence that she's not going to cuckold him? It's conformity to the patriarchal system. What is the evidence that they conform to the patriarchal system? It's religiousness. So you're going to have a system where religiousness is going to become selected for, particularly in women, where submission to the patriarchal system is going to become selected for, particularly in women. And women that don't conform will not pass on their genes. And so the way that you will get women who don't conform to the patriarchal system and who go into prostitution and illegitimacy and witchcraft and all these things that deviate from the patriarchal system is through mutation. So you'll get mutant genes. People who are high in mutational load will be born every generation, and they will die because the child mortality rate in 17th century, 18th century was 50%, and they will die out to varying degrees, of course, but they will die out. And what you would expect is for these people who deviated mentally from the norm in terms of not being patriarchal and thus being accused of witchcraft for that reason, you'd also expect them to have to express other maladaptive behavior, such as being mentally ill, such as having depression, such as having schizophrenia, such as histrionic disorder, such as being antisocial, such as all of the things that are associated with witches. So you'd expect them to be these ghastly, nasty, psychopathic women who we are warned in fairy tales that we have to avoid. These nasty women that live in gingerbread houses and kill you or whatever. And that's what these women were. They were at the bottom of society because, and not only that, but of course the brain is about 84% of the genome. And so if you've got mutations of the brain, you're going to for sure as damn it have mutations of the body because the brain is a massive target for mutation. And so this means that they're going to be physically ugly. They're going to have ugly faces and big noses and big chins, and they're going to age quickly, just as the stereotypical witch did. And so if you look in detail at those that were targeted, it was women who were spinsters. It was women. I think I read that it was over half of those that were executed for witchcraft across the 17th century were spinsters over the age of 50.
So that's because they were ugly, so they couldn't get married.
Exactly. Why were they spinsters? Because they were ugly, because men don't want ugly women. But then
the other 50% of them must have been sort of widows, sexually promiscuous.
Widows, prostitutes, those that practiced magic, whatever. But yeah, so generally they were physically unattractive. So you have a situation where under conditions of harsh Darwinian selection, health correlates with intelligence, health correlates with good character, intelligence, good genes, they all are comorbid. And so those that rise to the top in that kind of society are going to be highly patriarchal. And those that deviate from this will be at the bottom because of their personality, because of their low intelligence, and because of their high mutational load, which will mean that they'll be more likely to find them as being witches. So they were at the bottom of society, these people, these anti-feminists, these women who were adapted to a fast life history strategy ecology, an ecology basically of the pump and dump, of live fast, die young. That's the kind of people we're talking about, right? Basically women that were whores, sluts. That's wannabe whores and sluts. And that's who ends up at the bottom of society. Now, once those conditions break down, and that's what you get in 1800, once those conditions break down, so we go from 50% child mortality to 1% child mortality today, then you get a huge rise in mutational load across the population. You get more and more people who are mentally ill, more who deviate from what we were selected for. What we were selected for was to be patriarchal, was to be religious, was to be pro-social personality, and was to be intelligent. And you get more and more people that deviate from this, and it's going to normally be in a negative direction because we were so strongly selected for these things. And they are going to be higher in mutational load, and they're going to be physically ugly and whatever. But the selection pressure broke down first among the higher classes. They were under weaker selection pressure for longer. Medicine, what is it that weakens selection pressure? Good housing, access to medicine, wealth, basically. And so they have been under weaker selection for longer. And so you're going to expect higher mutational load. Remember, the heritability of socioeconomic status is very high. It's about 0.7. Higher mutational load among the higher classes. And therefore, the women who are these maladaptive, spiteful, mutant witches have moved from the lower classes to the upper classes. And you get these women in those classes who are anti-patriarchal, who advocate male roles for women, who are aggressive, who are anti-religious, who advocate destructive ideologies for the group, who advocate things that just mess the group up and make the group maladaptive in low and positive and negative ethnocentrism, who advocate the destruction. And what is it that causes a reduction in intermale conflict? Monogamy. So they advocate the breakdown of monogamy. So you have an increasing system whereby there's lots of men that can't get women. And so you have, you know, as we now see, and so you have, they have lesbinicious tendencies, and they are feminists. They call themselves feminists, and they are the modern day witches. And they are also physically ugly. I mean, there's detailed studies on this that show that feminist identification correlates with being ugly. It correlates with having masculine hands. It correlates with all kinds of markers of being ghastly and unattractive. So you have basically these witch spinsters of yore and the witch spinsters now. The social class has changed, but they are both witches. And the difference was that under pre-modern conditions, we were adapted to be skeptical, to be highly religious and thus skeptical of witches. So we dealt with them. Right? We jailed them or we hanged them. Now, because of build up a mutational load and also because of the destruction of the conservative society and the inculcation of society, the flip of society over to these leftist values that promotes leftist ideas, anti-group ideas as the norm. You know, once you reach about 20% of the society advocating maladaptive things, everyone moves over, apart from the genetic cream. Then people are inculcated by these feminists. Normal women are inculcated by these feminists to do maladaptive things, to delay fertility, to not have children, whatever, to destroy their own children, to allow their own children to be transsexuals, to whatever it happens to be. And so that's what I think we've got. The modern day feminists are literally witches. And when James VI of Scotland said witches are real, yeah, they are. And they're here now and they're called feminists.
But he didn't mean, just for the sake of clarification, when James VI said that, he didn't mean that witches are real in the sense of supernatural beings, you know, working with potions that alter, you know, affect life in a metaphysical way, did he?
Yeah. He strongly believed in, he literally believed in witches, and he believed that they tried to kill him when he was trying to get married to his Norwegian wife, and they tried to sink his ship. And that's how the this witch craze in southern Scotland in the 1590s. That's how that started, and lots of people were killed.
Out of interest, do you believe that there is any supernatural element to this? And presumably not.
No, but I think that what you're dealing with the same type of people, but for the reason the reason I laid out, these people have migrated from the lower class, from what was called the lower sort, the people at the bottom of society, to the people basically near the top of society, which is where these feminists tend to be.
The champagne socialists.
But you've got to, I'm talking about the really extreme examples, because a champagne socialist might just be some stupid private schoolgirl that, like Harriet Harman or something, that pushes the society in a maladaptive direction. I'm talking about the people that influence her. So the Andrea Dworkins, the Kate Millets, the real battle axe feminists. Now, one of the interesting things about, and it's a parallel. So what we're thinking is that women are selected to patriarchy. Who is selected to be what does that mean? It means that the woman is submissive. It means that the woman is selected to what's called a slow life history strategy. A woman that's selected to patriarchy is the kind of woman that is selected to a society where you invest. The man invests in the woman, and the man invests in the children, and the woman invests in the man and is loyal to the man, and the woman invests and nurtures the children. So we're talking about a mother rather than a whore, basically. If you think about what's called a fast, the deviation from this is a fast life history strategy. If you're evolved to an unstable ecology, live fast, die young, you could be wiped out at any minute. And so you don't bother with nurture and bonding with people, because there might never be any payoff.
R-type and K-type.
Yeah, R-type individual. That's right, as we talked about last year. And so those people...
There is actually the expression fast women, ironically, from decades gone by.
Yeah, well, that's what we're talking about. That these kinds of women, right? And so they are evolved to an ecology of violence and whatever, where the men don't invest in them. It's not patriarchal at all. The men don't invest in them. They are not invested in. They have to take on some of the male roles. It's perhaps a polygamy, and the man will invest in them for a bit and then shun them in favor of the new, younger, more nubile wife. And so they will have to bring up their children somehow. One of the things they will do, by the way, is alloparent. So they'll get together with other co-wives and like lesbiniciously bring up the children. And it's been suggested that that's, you know, the heritability of sexuality in women is very, very low. It's 0.2. And it's been suggested that one of the reasons for this is that women are adapted to this kind of situation where you have to be able to, you're going to get dumped, basically. So you have to be able to bring up your children. And so you bond strongly to the point of sex with another woman, and you co-parent your children, which is what happened to Sanna Marin, who's the current Prime Minister of Finland. We have it, by the way, a kind of witch government of Finland. Well, I call them the Spice Girls.
Spiteful girls.
That's very good. My Scottish friend in Olu calls them the Spice Girls. He came up with that one. But the Spiteful Girls, that's excellent. That's very good. I might have to quote you on that. But Spites, no, it doesn't work. But anyway, what you have is these women who are more, because they have to take on some of the masculine roles, because they're not being looked after. There's no patriarchy. They're more masculinized. They're much more physically and mentally masculinized. Now, one of the things that's interesting in terms of the witch, and therefore they're physically ugly and unattractive, which is true stereotypically and provenly true of these feminists, and of course true based on the historical sources of these witches, masculinized, unattractive, ugly women, also fast life history strategy, greater genetic diversity, more ugliness. But what's fascinating is the fantasies they have. So it's been shown that women, feminist identification, weakly correlates with having rape fantasies. Now, why would that be the case? Well, because if you're in a fast life history ecology, the kind of man you want, the kind of man whose genes will be passed on, the kind of man who, if you have his children, your children will survive, will be a violent, domineering kind of guy, because that's who survives in an unstable ecology. Selection isn't particularly favoring intelligence or emotions or character or whatever. It favors a violent, you know, sort of WWE wrestler Chris Benoit type. Well, that's not perhaps a good example, but whatever, you know.
But it's interesting that such women also create social discord so that it is the violent men who will be able to survive that situation.
That's a very good point. Precisely, that's what I want to move on to now. You're ahead of me here, Woz. So it's like sperm selection. So the man ejaculates with 500 million spermatozoa, and the woman's immune system, she wants to get pregnant, but she also does everything she can to kill the sperm, so that only the strongest possible sperm can get through. Only the R strategy sperm, if you like, can get through. So she violently repels the sperm, like she's being raped. She fights it off. And ultimately, only the strongest man, the strongest sperm, if any of them, can get past her violent defences. And then that's the one by which she gets pregnant. Well, that's how these rape fantasies work. The woman is dominated by a raped. She's fantasizing about being raped by a fast life history man who can't keep his hands off her. But ultimately, by doing that, he's proving, ironically, that paradoxically, that he's the man she wants. And so these fast life history strategy women will tend to have rape fantasies. And feminist identification has been shown to correlate with having, ironically, having rape fantasies. And two of the major feminists that, or second wave feminists that you may have heard of, Andrea Dworkin and Kate Millett, both had intense rape fantasies and wrote about them. In the case of Andrea Dworkin, she thought it was real. Obviously it wasn't. I mean, she was a fat, ugly, hairy old woman. Interestingly, I've got a paper that's coming out soon on this. If you look at the witches in the 17th century, right? First of all, in England, not Scotland, forget Scotland, that's different. In England, they weren't subject to torture. Other than in the case of Matthew Hopkins, the Witchfinder General, where they were walked and sleep deprived. But put that aside, they weren't subject to torture. They admitted freely to, in many cases, it's documented, to being raped, to having sex with the devil. The devil appeared to me in the form of a black man, and he had sex with me on 6 consecutive nights. The devil appeared in my chamber, and he sucked my breasts until it hurt, and then he had sex with me from behind. Now, what I think these were rape fantasies. And I think, you know, these are the kind of women who we would expect to have rape fantasies, these fast life history strategy, relatively fast life history strategy women. And I think that they were having, there's no reason they weren't tortured, they weren't induced. And if you go back, the idea of the incubus is very ancient. It's not some new thing that was created or something by the patriarchy to have a go at women or whatever. It's very ancient, the idea of the incubus, of women, these night devils. And equally...
Is that the same as the succubus?
The succubus is a woman. Succubus is a woman. And so, now, and that's an interesting point as well, because if you look at the research on BDSM, so people that like, you know, hitting and whipping and caning and stuff like this, those people tend to be fast life history strategists. And also the tendency is for the women to like to be hit, which makes sense, and the men to like to hit. Now, why is that the case? Well, because we know from the evolution of sex, there's a very interesting book on this by... it's called A History of Rape or something, A Natural History of Rape. I can't remember the name of the author, Palmer and something or other. And they look at this, that why is sex related to violence? Why do men become more aroused by violent porn than normal porn? They become more aroused by rape porn than normal porn. They ejaculate more when watching rape porn and violent porn than normal porn. Right. What's going on? Well, what's happening is that in prehistory, men that raped passed on more of their genes. Of course. So how do you pass on your genes? Normally within marriage or whatever, but also by ganging together and going around and, you know, gang raping, as you see with these Muslim immigrants, whatever, that are right at the bottom of society. That's how you do it. And so therefore it would make sense that a man would be sexually aroused by violence. It would make sense that the two would go together because it was the men that were sexually aroused. Right.
Yeah, I have heard that the parts of the brain in men that process violence and process sex are overlapping. I don't know if that's a physical thing functional correlation.
Equally with women, you're going to get the same sort of thing. The women that would be in a sense be aroused by violence would get the more violent man and that would be the man with the better gene quality in a fast life history strategy ecology, or the women that would just give in and allow them, would not be killed or whatever. So there was an advantage to being aroused by violence, and this would be higher among fast life history strategy people. And so you can see where these relationships come from, and then that you can again further understand the relationship between fast life history strategy non-patriarchal types and this rape fantasies and whatever. So I think that's what you're dealing with, and I think that basically these it's this irony that these women who are these feminists and whatever go on and on about how I'm an independent woman, and they ultimately probably want to be hit and smacked and beaten up, and that's what they want. And
there does seem to be a correlation. I mean, you hear about this, a correlation between women who hate men and women who want to be beaten up by men, and rape fantasies and so on. Just for the sake of clarification, because some people are saying in the live chat that they don't have rape fantasy, they don't like violent porn. For the record,
wait a minute, we are a broadly nationalist show, so people who are going to watch are going to be highly group selected and patriarchal, so why would they like rape fantasies and violent porn?
I just wondered because you were saying it's part of our makeup from
it is part of our makeup, but you're going to get group and individual variation in the extent of it. And what I would expect is that the kind of people that were religious or were patriarchal or who would have survived under harsh Darwinian conditions that I'm talking about, they would be less inclined towards this stuff than the mutants, than the feminists, than the witches, than whatever. So that's it. So if I was on this show and there were a load of leftists watching and they were perfectly honest, then I think they would perhaps say that I bloody well like this kind of stuff. Now, the other thing I was going to say though, with the succubus that you mentioned, with the succubus, was that the relationship is in general that when it comes to BDSM, the men like to be the dominant partner and the woman the submissive, but there is crossover, and so you do get some, particularly men, that like to be the submissive. Why? Well, because if the woman can dominate them, then there's a sense in which it's like she's a fast efficient strategy woman, her genes would survive, good to get her pregnant, So you can see how there would be some crossover. But in general, not. So basically that's it. So the rise of feminism then is on that level extremely bad for society. It's the rise of anti-ethnocentrism. It elevates into male conflict, and it makes the society a group selected, and those that are less group selected, and those that are advocating it are in that sense paralleling modern witches. The second problem then is what another element to a society that dominates, that wins in the battle of group selection, is ingenuity, is intelligence, is genius. What the genius is outlier, high IQ combined with... By the way, you said there's a chat. I can't see the chat. Where is this chat that you're seeing? I can't see any chat in the comments.
Oh, it's on... Hold on. All right, yes, because StreamYard doesn't show that. Hold on a second. I'll show you where it is. I'll send this to you on Telegram so you can...
All right.
You're not on Telegram. Right, I'll send it to you there you go.
All right, what's that on then? Oh, yes, there. All right, so I thought... is that if another way that you win in the battle of group selection is genius. So the reason why, even though the Japanese and the Chinese are more ethnocentric than us, they have a smaller gene pool than us, and they produce fewer per capita geniuses. They have fewer outliers. They produce fewer geniuses. And so what is the genius? The genius is outlier high intelligence plus moderately psychopathic traits. That's what the genius is. And so that means that he can come up with the original idea, and he thinks outside the box, low conscientiousness, and he doesn't care about offending people, which new ideas almost always do. I had a chap on my show, and he's disputing dark matter. And there's so much wrapped up in that that he's like an outcast in physics, just disputing dark matter. Women are a problem then. The promotion of women in academia then becomes, and in life in general, becomes a problem because women are this less female genius. And so if women come to one of the things that you have to do is you have to nurture geniuses. They're often these kind of impractical types. They need someone to, do their laundry for them or do their cooking for them or whatever. And so the universities were a place that nurtured genius. they would allow these people to get there and just get on with it. It was about finding out the truth. Indeed, these universities were founded originally on religious lines, that we're here to discover the nature of God's creation, and to lie is therefore blasphemy. Now, it's been suggested by Simon Baron Cohen that you have an extreme male brain, which is basically autistic and focused on systematizing, and therefore essentially low in agreeableness and low in conscientiousness and sort of quite high in testosterone. They intercorrelate. That's the male brain. High in systematizing, but blind to empathy. And the female brain is very high in empathy, but system blind. So what the female is concerned about is not truth, is not systematics, understanding the world. There are things that are more important than truth, like everyone getting along and being happy and feeling validated and all that.
Yes, stuff. Of course.
So yeah. This is inimical to the search, to what the genius does, which is the search for truth. And so if you have a society where women are allowed into higher education, then eventually you're going to get the distinction between the genius, who's going to be outlier intelligent but socially awkward and, crap to work with and whatever, and the head girl type, the type who runs Finland, the straight-A pupil at school, who's very reasonably intelligent but not outlier intelligent, and who's very conscientious and very hard-working.
Very conformist.
Socially skilled and conformist, absolutely conformist. Women are higher in conformism than men, much higher in conformism than men, because they're higher in agreeableness and higher in conscientiousness. And so who's going to get the job if you're put up with a genius and someone like that? Well, obviously, it's going to be the woman that's going to get the job. Who would you like to work with? And so then original ideas and originality and new ideas and whatever goes, and the whole spirit of academia, that it's to do with coming up with original ideas and challenging convention and whatever, come what may, is suppressed in favor of the new model of university as a kind of nursery school where everyone's a winner and everyone has to be happy and whatever. And eventually, once the women make up about 20% of an organization, it's starts to tip towards them and their values start to take over. And so the values of academia, which is the pursuit of the truth no matter what, which is the genius strategy, that where you find out things, that goes. And so you have a society dominated by women, and all these things that would have happened, think of all the inventions that have come about, rockets, people that died in the attempt to get to the moon. All of this wouldn't happen because you have women in charge, and women are averse to these things, and they want everyone to
be wrong. Yeah, absolutely. And so modern academia is a very conformist space which specializes in enforcing a consensus and a doctrine. I mean, I did a video, just for the sake of plugging here, I did a video back at the very start, 2014, called How Feminism Killed the Space Age. And it was basically making this point that once you have women in charge of things, there is going to be less innovation, and there's going to be less, because women are less interested in things that aren't immediately useful. I think that men have an ability to get, and they also have something called, I would call, random curiosity. I did a video with that title as well, where I was making that point that men can be fascinated by things which are not immediately relevant or useful. But which end up being extremely relevant and useful. And I think that difference alone means that an academia dominated by women is going to be much less intellectually curious, which is exactly what we see now. I mean, it's,
precisely. Yeah. So that's downstream of the destruction of patriarchy and what that does to ethnocentrism. That's the next problem. Now, the next problem then is that a lot of these women are, of course, adapted to patriarchy. Well, most women are adapted to some extent to patriarchy, undermine the patriarchy, undermine the religious system, and what you get is this free for all that we now have. This what they promote, these feminists, is not just feminism, but is this broader undermining of the traditional system, and what that does is it undermines group selectiveness.
Just before you continue, there's one thing that just occurred to me that I think Germaine Greer actually said that if women had been in charge all along, we would still be living in caves. I think that there's a quote from Germaine Greer about this. Let me just see if I can find it, but it's basically backing up what you and I are saying here. Let me see if I can see it. Yeah, I don't know. I can't find it now. But anyway, I'm pretty sure that even Germaine Greer is on our side on this.
I wouldn't be at all surprised. And by the way, she has this fast life history strategy background. She was beaten up by her parents and things. She confesses to this. So you get the downwind of that. Then the next thing you get is the general leftism of these feminists. So it's undermining patriarchy. It's undermining traditional values, promoting things like antinatalism and whatever. Being a feminist, as with the witches of yore, being a feminist and being left-wing woman, of course, is associated with being mentally ill. Why? Because it's a reflection of general mutational load. And also having high levels of depression tends to be associated with being individualistic and self-interested, and just everything's bad, everything's awful, and having just a negative view of the world. And then the next thing that becomes the problem is that it creates this arms race of virtue signaling, where you have to move on to the next group and the next group and the next group. And under normal conditions, women are more religious than men. And they're adapted to patriarchy and they're more religious than men. And this makes them more right-wing and more conservative than men. If you undermine the religiosity, if you undermine the patriarchy, which directs the women, because the women, remember, are evolved to be directed. They are evolved to not make decisions for themselves, but to make their fathers make the decisions or their husbands make the decisions. Then, of course, they become completely maladaptive, more so than men. And this is what you see. So once the religiousness collapses and the religiousness itself stops being a protective force, they are more religious than men, but it becomes this left-wing, deracinated religion of just pathological altruism, of generalized altruism, which means they're highly in favor of immigration and stuff like that. And they make these very maladaptive decisions, which result in lots and lots of them not having any children and things like this. Furthermore, it may be the case that women are literally selected to be less ethnocentric than men, because under prehistoric conditions, it would be the women that would be abducted and taken away by other tribes and raped by them and whatever. And so if they could be less ethnocentric, then they'd be more likely to survive. That may also be why women are better at learning languages than men, perhaps. And then,
well, they're also more social. I mean, they need language in a more immediate way than, yeah.
Yes. And then the next thing is the issue of transsexuality, which is which I think is absolutely fascinating. So you then move on to the next minority group, you know, this constant empathy, this constant desire to constantly help the unfortunate and help the marginalized and whatever. And then you end up with the issue of transsexuality. Now, I think that it associates with this sort of stuff in the sense that it's like, I mean, it's kind of demonic. It's basically telling us, it says in the Bible, the devil is the father of lies. And it's basically telling us that lies are truth and truth is lies. The purpose is to make us in a situation where there's no structure, there's no order. In religious terms, God decides what you are. God is the source of ultimate truth. And you know, God says you're a man. God says you're a woman. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the light. God is truth. There is objective truth. God is truth. And the only person who is his own truth is God. And what these transsexuals are saying is, if I say I am something, then I am that. And in that sense, they are saying, I am God. And so you could argue that, like the devil, they are literally a fallen angel that is challenging God. And I look at this in the book, and it's worse than that. If you look at these things about titles, who is it that we give a special pronoun to? It's God. God gets a capital H. Who is it that demands their own pronouns and to have different, you know, I say what my pronoun is? Transsexuals. And who is it that we says to you, look, this is how I have to be addressed. I have to be addressed like this. And if you cheek me, I will banish you. The monarch. Who is it that asserts, oh, I have to be addressed in this way. And if you know, that's what you have to do. And I want sanctions if you don't. Transsexuals. So it strikes me that there is something kind of demonic about this. It's to humiliate people and to just grind them into the dirt and say there's no meaning, there's no nothing, this is just hell. There's no meaning, there's no logic, there's nothing. It's just about power. It's about power. And you bow down to me. Bow down to me. And I say, if I say I'm a man, I'm a man. If I say I'm a woman, I'm a woman. And that's it. It's power. And that's either saying you're God or it's something demonic, as far as I can see. I don't literally believe in this. I'm saying that's how you can interpret it.
Yeah. And it does say, I think Roger Scruton might have made this point as well, that when he saw leftists rioting in 1968 in Paris, it was as if they were wanting to be God. They were wanting to take control of, to have power over everything. He made some vague point in that direction, which I'm completely misquoting it, but that was the broad point that he was making. Apparently, it was Camille Paglia who said that about it wasn't Germaine Greer, by the way, earlier on. People are correcting me.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Heard her.
Yeah. You take it off. Go on.
No, I was just going to say that what you have with it's quite interesting. This what you have with these transsexuals. If you want to understand what's going on, the transsexuality is strongly associated with autism. It's also strongly associated with being masculinized. I did a paper on this recently. It's one of the only papers that's got like an immediate complaint demand saying it should never have passed peer review and it should never have been published. And that was published by the journal, and that was written, of course, by a trans woman. And what they are a trans woman academic, and what they are saying is it's all of these markers of being masculinized are associated with being a trans woman. So trans women, that's male to female transsexuals, are more masculinized psychologically and physically than the average man. Now, what this is fascinating, isn't it? Now, what that means, autism is an expression of, which is low empathy, high systematizing, whatever, is an expression of masculinization. So people that are high in autistic traits are more tend to be more masculinized. So that's consistent with that. Now, what you get with autism is you get a limited sense of self. So the sense of who you are, a sense of having this is me and this is who I am and this is my place in the world, doesn't develop properly. And it doesn't develop properly because autistics don't pick up on social cues very well, and they're easily overwhelmed by stimuli, and so they feel that they're in a world of sort of chaos and that they're not in control of things. And so they feel almost separate from themselves, almost like they're watching their lives pan out and they have no control over it, which is why some autistic people will refer to themselves in the third person and things like this. And so that's what that then is associated with what's called borderline personality disorder, which is when you have a fundamental lack of self, and your world is chaos and there's this void at the heart of you, and you deal with that.
And this is usually women who have borderline.
That is more likely to be women, and you deal with this although it's also present in men, and you deal with this by creating a separate sort of personality or something like a black and white, clear sense of structure that gives life meaning and whatever. But that can be unstable, and that can and sometimes that will break down and you'll flip to the exact opposite of it. And you see that in religious converts, and you see that in the alt-right, people that go from being far left to being far right to being Christian fundamentalists to being whatever, right? You see people like this. Now, one thing that's parallel, that's very similar to borderline personality, and it's perhaps an example of it, is narcissistic personality. And this is much more common among men. And yes, this is when, and this is when, because you are also, you take your, the way you deal with your chaos and your void at the heart of your life is to create a very, very superior sense of self, this idea that you're better than others and whatever. But you also need to have this, others need to tell you that's the case. Others need to worship you and whatever, so that you're reassured that you are, in fact, brilliant. And when they fail to do that, indeed, when they do something which questions your sense of self or questions the dogmas which you believe in, and because you believe in them, you're brilliant and whatever, when those are questioned by them, this can trigger narcissistic rage. because you can realize that this will undermine everything and you will be confronted with the hell and the nothing that you are. And so you can see that you've got these two things: narcissism, which goes together with a limited sense of self, which goes together with borderline personality. So one of the things and then another thing that's associated with autism is sexual fetishes. Autistics and people that are masculine, men in general, are focused on things. So a man will say, oh, I'm a breast man, or I'm an ass man, you know. And what a fetish is that taken to a kind of extremes. You know, you can only get it up if there's a nice pair of tits or whatever. And these fetishes can then become things that are associated with sexual things that are actually sexual. Like, I don't know, people that want to have, you know, like leather or something like that. And these are more common among autistics. Now, this all comes together in the transsexual, according to research by Blanchard, because the transsexual is a narcissist. Transsexuals are high in narcissism. And the transsexual's fetish is that he is sexually aroused by the idea of himself as a woman.
Oh my God, this is like in Silence of the Lambs. Would you fuck me? I'd fuck me. I'd fuck me hard. Buffalo Bill.
Right. Well, that's what we're talking about. They are sexually aroused by the idea of themselves as women. There's a small minority where, yeah, it is true, they are intersexual or whatever. But in general, that's what we're talking about. They're sexually aroused by the idea of themselves as a woman. And they're also, you know, and why would that be the case? Well, because they're narcissistic. And so what you would expect then, if they're narcissistic, is they would demand that society accepts them as women. And they would demand, and they would get narcissistic rage and go bonkers if people questioned them, which they do. And they'd be very aggressive, because remember, they're very masculinized, and indeed they're narcissistic. And I think that makes it, I don't think we should even call them, what do we call them, transgender, I should just call them trans narcissists, that's what they are. And so what is the devil? What is the narcissist? The narcissist is the person, in a sense, that thinks he's God. And so that's what these people kind of think they are. And so I think it's extremely dangerous. These people are seriously mentally ill. They are a danger to society. They're narcissists. They're capable of narcissistic rage and all that entails. And they should, the idea that they should be given equal rights or something is insane. This I also look at in the book, is that this feminism, this witchcraft just takes us down into the bowels of hell.
Well, indeed, it is quite, there is a dizzying array of personality disorders that one can encounter in life. And I think that a lot of us, I certainly wasn't familiar with it until maybe a couple of years ago. And they are very dangerous and destructive people. I think it would be useful if you were to talk about, you know, you were saying earlier about witches being antisocial, causing problems in the community and so on. Could you go into some examples or just detail about that? I mean, what would it be that they were doing? Preface this. Obviously, women are capable of a degree of social intelligence that I think often completely eludes men, and so they can do things, they can set things up that really take men by surprise. I think women are very good at that. And so there are all sorts of subtle, small things that could be set up by a malicious woman, which then have devastating effects for the community. Would you like to talk about this?
In the book, I look at examples from the 17th century, which was the height of the witch craze. And so it's things like, she put a spell on my cow and made the cow, and the cow died. Probably she poisoned the cow. So nasty things like this. Babies, killing babies was a big thing that they were often accused of, killing other people's babies. And so it may have been that there was that kind of behavior. You know, you get these nurses, there was a case recently, and then there was a case in the early 90s, nurses killing babies and whatever, and there's that. You have them just being just cursing people and telling them that cursing them with, and a society that believed in the power of the curse. They believed in the power of the curse. People believed this. And they tell them, I curse you, I hope you're infertile and whatever. And so they engaged in what you would call the nocebo effect, effect. It's the opposite of the placebo effect. And it can be extremely powerful. If you believe in the nocebo effect, then it can make you infertile if you really believe it. And these people did believe it. They believed in the power of the witch's curse, and people would identify as witches. They'd be known as witches, and they'd curse people.
That's the power of suggestion.
The power of... So, exactly. I mean, there was a case of a known witch, and she, a little girl, she was about 16 years old, and she was walking past, this is about 1610, and she was in a Pendle in Yorkshire, and she was in Lancashire, is it? And she was walking past this guy called John Laws, and she asked him to give her some pins, and he wouldn't give her any pins, which we used to hold clothes together. So she cursed him, and he immediately fell down and had a stroke. And then she admitted, she felt really guilty at what she'd done, and she admitted, she admitted, I cursed him, and I did this, and they hanged her. And so that's the kind of thing they would engage in, deeply and antisocial, nasty behavior, which for the people at the time was very serious and was taken very, very seriously and had, as far as they could see, serious consequences. So that's what we're talking about. And what do these feminists do now? They engage in antisocial behavior. They sit behind keyboards telling you, I hope your children get killed in a car accident. You know, they smash up public.
They also, yeah. And another thing that feminists do, and you see this in, you know, public life now, is they specialize in destroying men's character, like discrediting.
Oh yeah,
and so, like, I mean, that's a huge part.
That judge. That Trump appointed some Scottishy or foreign Irishy sounding name, and the moment he was appointed,
oh, Kavanaugh,
right? And all of these women who would. Some of them were a bit ugly, frankly, who had dated him in the past, suddenly came forward after 30 years or 40 years. Oh, he raped me, touched me up, you know. And you had this hysteria of all these women, one after the other, coming forward, you know, because this person had dumped them, basically, or refused to have sex with them or something. And so they had born a grudge, as women do, for a very, very, very long time. And they had seen this person get into a position of power and success, and the resentment that they felt, they wanted to bring him down. And these would perhaps be the kind of women that would have rape fantasies, that would have fantasies that he raped them, and that would deal with the feeling of humiliation of being scorned by concocting this. I mean, that we know that the nature of memory is such that it's highly inaccurate, and you will tend to literally alter your memories to make you seem good at any given time. And so you can see how one way you would do that is, you know, if you get dumped by a girl and you alter the memory to, oh, well, yeah, it was a mutual thing or whatever. And you might genuinely believe that. And you can see how fast life history strategy women would have rape fantasies and things. And if it made them feel better that they had those, they would genuinely believe it happened. Yeah, I wasn't dumped by this guy because I'm ghastly. He dumped me, but it was good that he dumped me because he raped me. And all of this came out, and none of the allegations were taken. You know, went to court, and because they were sure they were all false. And so you get this in the wake of divorces as well. Women concoct all kinds of things. He hit me, you know, and it turns out that she's exaggerating or whatever. And so, yeah, I think that's the damage that a lot of modern feminists do. That's why it's so dangerous to have this idea in British courts that they should automatically be taken seriously. Automatically, no, I would say quite the opposite.
Or believe all women and so on. Yeah, it is very dangerous because I think that, I mean, obviously men are capable of all sorts of crimes. Of course they are. And they're also capable of deluding themselves. But I think that women seem to have, especially when encouraged by society, women have an ability to believe whatever is necessary. Now, obviously, I'm not saying all women do this or whatever. No, I'm just saying it seems to be something that's more of a tendency.
If you think about the kind of person that is high in empathy or high, we think about what we talk about multiculturalism and it being inconsistent. Of course, it's inconsistent to say race is a social construct and then to say, oh, we need more black people to donate their organs because black people are dying because there's no black donor organs. Well, that shows that race isn't a social construct. Clearly, that shows it maps onto something very important indeed. And they can hold together. They're like the Queen of Hearts from Alice in Wonderland. They can hold together two contradictory things. It doesn't matter to them because there's things that are more important. There's power. Power is more important. so they can engage in tactical nihilism, and they can, you know, when it's race, there's no clear borders and whatever. Where's anything else? There is. Or when it's race, there's no clear borders when I'm arguing with a racist, but when I want money, then yeah, race exists. It's very real.
Of course.
You can't be transracial. Yeah. And that's a complete contradiction. But they don't care about that, because what they care about is power or empathy. That's the other thing. Okay, you give someone a logical, reasonable argument, and the response of an extreme female type woman who traditionally would perhaps be quite patriarchal would be, oh, well, that's just so mean. So mean. You're like, yeah, but it's true. And it's true. Woes is Scottish. Yeah, but it's so mean to say he's Scottish. Scottish is degenerate. It's so mean to say he's Scottish, or whatever. And the Scottish are run by wee Jimmy Cranky, you know. And so it's fine. It's fine. And so you see what I mean. So that's why it's so dangerous in terms of academia, in terms of science, in terms of what I'm interested in, to allow women to overwhelm. I'm not saying there shouldn't be any women in academia, but when they started it at Oxford, they brought in women, and then it was found that it interfered with the ability to have harsh academic disputations. And then they reduced the numbers, and they said there could only be one woman to every seven men, because they took the view that it wasn't working. And eventually, of course, they overturned that, and they brought them in. I remember talking to an academic, a British academic, who working in Finland, and they have a thing here called a PhD defence. Now, it's meant to be a formality. And you've got them having a party arranged in the next room, a thing called a karonka, and whatever. But as far as he was concerned, the thesis was that he presented with was not very good. And it was the first time he'd done one of that. He was, you're meant to have an opponent. And the idea is that the opponent, you know, pulls apart your thesis and you defend it. Now, that's what happens in a British. Well, if you've ever had a PhD viva, it's private though, but you've got your internal, I had one, you've got your internal examiner, your external examiner, and their purpose is to rip your thesis apart, and your purpose is to defend it. And this is being criticized increasingly, because of course you end up with, if a girl has presented a thesis that only just passes or whatever, or it's not very good, then they'll end up in tears. Because the people are being... And this is what happened at this defence. The guy was expecting... He'd never done it before. He was expecting an academic disputation. It was a female PhD student, and he basically just pulled it apart. And she was almost crying. And he couldn't believe it. And people said to her afterwards, I think you were maybe a little bit too harsh. And he's like, what do you mean a little bit too harsh? I was presenting her with the problems with her thesis, and I was asking for her... response. What do you mean?
Mm. And of course, if it was a person who was committed to the truth, no matter what, they wouldn't really care about their own. They would separate their own feelings from the matter at hand, from the mission, as it were.
That's right. But a lot of women, I think, like Jill Biden or whatever, they don't get PhDs as a means of knowing more about the nature of the world. They get PhDs because it's a tick VG, good girl picture on the fridge.
All right. So somebody makes the comment, of course, this is when we were talking about society, stability, women, witches and so on. And someone said, so it's all women's fault then. What would you say about that?
No. Maybe you could argue that it's men's fault for not standing up against this nonsense. And a lot of the spiteful mutants that have undermined the patriarchy and have undermined the traditional system have been men. So it's not all women's fault, no. But I'm just showing you that the parallel is very, very clear, as far as I can see, between the witches of yore and the feminists of now.
Okay. We have some super chats. We'd love to know Ed's thoughts on Gnosticism. Would it be a preferable Christian alternative for us?
Well, in the early church, so Gnosticism was this sort of esoteric belief system where you sort of gain greater knowledge and through your own esoteric belief you get closer to Christ. And I think that in the early church they were very unhappy about Gnosticism because it was so subjective and whatever, and so it would break down into all kinds of infighting and things like this. And so then eventually they the Gnostics were sort of wiped out. They were considered an element that, as it were, didn't help in the matter of group selection. So I'm not sure. I'm just trying to. I was writing about Gnosticism quite recently. I'm just trying to find the document. Here it is. So I'm just trying to remember what it was they were unhappy about with Gnosticism. But you had these various Gnostic sects that they didn't get the balance right. So one of the things was that they were extremely sort of generally pro-social rather than ethnocentric, and so that was potentially a problem. Or they believed in all kinds of weird stuff, which meant which wasn't in line with the broader church, and so that meant there was splitting and disagreement, and so that was a problem. For example, Marcion, the blasphemous heretic Marcion, preached that the Jewish God had created the world, but that a higher God had sent Jesus to the world. And there were some of them that believed that the Sethians, that Seth in Genesis was the receiver of crucial revelations and was kind of a divine savior. The Ophites believed that Jesus had instructed them to worship the serpent from Genesis because he was the genuine source of knowledge. And so a lot of these things weren't even particularly Christian at all. They involved sexual rituals and stuff like that. No, I'm not sure that there would be a great deal of future. A lot of these Gnostic sects were not particularly ethnocentric. And I think that was why they got rid of them in the end. They weren't ethnocentric enough. They were promoting a brotherhood of man to a great an extent. And so they were selected out. There was basically an evolutionary battle of different ideas that were expressed in religious terms. And it was the Gnostic ones that were selected out. So I suppose not then.
All right, and another super chat. I don't know what this is referring to, but he says, Ed, I had a fat Norwegian forest cat that lived to be 18. I'm not sure if this is a reference to something.
He's referring to my cat, Margaret the cat.
Oh, yeah, and then he says, how is Margaret doing?
I'll just see if Margaret's around. Just a minute.
Okay. People can post... There.
But she's been great because the kids have been in northern Lapland in a place called Kebijärvi for the last few days, and so they haven't been here to stress Margaret out, and so she's been a completely different cat. I mean, she's been sociable, she's been upstairs with us, and just like not the antisocial cow that she normally is. So and she's been spayed, which I believe extends their life expectancy. And she's 12. She's what is Margaret? She's 13, I think it is now. She's 13. So I think she could live quite a lot. But she does, to the extent, I think she's a moggy, but to the extent that she's anything, she does look a bit like a Norwegian forest cat. That is true.
All right. They look very nice and fluffy and cuddly.
Very fluffy. Very, very furry. Very luxurious looking. Okay. Cat.
All right. Hi, Ed. Why are the Ulster Scots so fiercely loyalist and pro-Britain, while Scots in Scotland seem to be slowly edging in the direction of abolishing the Union, Great Britain? Why are people who are so similar ethnically beginning to diverge so drastically in their political expressions?
So I think that there's two reasons. One is that it's just the basic political reason that the Ulster Scots are Protestant, and therefore and they see themselves, they are different from the Catholics religiously, and they are different from the Catholics ethnically, genetically. And so and they want to remain, obviously, that it's a choice between being part of a Catholic, they're deeply committed religious people, and that it's a choice between being part of a Catholic Ireland, or a religious Catholic Ireland, or historically it was, and a choice of being part of Britain. And so it would be a humiliation for them to be part of Britain, and so to be part of Ireland, and so therefore they are very, very pro being part of Britain. Secondly, I think you've got to understand that the Ulster Scots are not representative of the Scots any more than the English people of Virginia or the English people of Massachusetts are representative of the English. These immigrants tend to be more religious. And particularly if they went there a long time, immigration is correlated with religiousness. They were very religious people. They were under group selection more harshly because of violence or whatever in Ulster. So they're highly, 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 highly religious. They're a fundamentalist community, and therefore they tend to be very conservative and against change and whatever. And therefore you would expect them to want to stay part of Britain. Whereas the Scots, they've not been subject to that, so they're going to be the religiousness and the traditionalism and whatever is going to be less of an issue, and the nationalism element as well is going to be higher. What is it that's used to hold things together? What held nations together? The group selection, the threat of destruction. Well, that's gone. There's no Russia. There's not going to be a nuclear war. There's no. That's on the check. So we'd expect things to fall apart. We'd expect the European Union to fall apart. We'd expect Britain to fall apart. Britain came together because of war with other European countries and stayed together because there was something in it for the Scots. The Scots were dominant in the empire. They were hugely overrepresented in the empire and indeed in geniuses, in British geniuses. I mean, pretty much, you know, they were a tiny population. I suspect they were more intelligent than us until quite recently, because they were under harsh Darwinian selection pressures. They were better at killing their witches, and so on. So they have every reason to be part of the Union. Whereas then you have this moving apart, and so then you have this rise in Scottish nationalism, which has happened in Scotland. Their sense of national identity becomes wrapped up in their religiousness in a way. We're better than the British because we're more left wing, and that's kind of what their Scottish nationalism is. We're better than the English because we're more the Sassenachs, because we're more woke than them, even though we can afford to be more woke because we're like 98% white. But even so, and so that's why those are the reasons why I think there's a difference. And also, you should remember that the Ulster Scots and the Scots diverged a very long time ago. I mean, we're talking the 1600s here, early 1700s at the latest. So it's a and the people that emigrate, as I say, are always more conservative. The Afrikaans are more, even the language is more conservative. I suspect that the way the Northern Irish speak is probably how the Scots spoke in the 1600s, and it's just been preserved. Like the way that we know that the way that the Cornish spoke in the 1600s is the way Virginians speak now. And the way that the Dutch spoke in the 1600s is the way Afrikaans speak now. So I think that's, I mean, they like, the Scots people saying I, right, for yes, I. That's a very old word. It's died out in England. There's some people say it in Scotland, in Northern Ireland. They love it. They can't get enough of it all the time. I, and so on. So I think that's my answer.
All right. Thank you. Okay. So, Mr. Dutton. Professor Dutton, is removing female equality that was established into Western law in 1920 for most Anglo nations the right solution for a nationalist and traditionalist to aim to achieve? Removing female equality that was established in law in 1920.
Who asked this?
Someone who's constantly asking questions about women. he says he's not a MGTOW, but it's time to grow and learn.
I don't know what you're talking about, that female equality was put into law in 1920. I dispute that. Like, what do you mean? I mean, in England, for example, women were allowed to become priests in 1992. Women weren't allowed to engage in boxing until the late 90s. Women couldn't be bishops in England until relatively recently.
I think he means it's a more legal level.
Do you mean in America, women got the right to vote in 1920? Is that what you mean?
I'm guessing so, yeah.
Right. So it is interestingly, there was a very interesting book by a chap called Simon Webb, who I interviewed on my channel. And he showed that these women that wanted the vote, when the Women's Social and Political Union broke down, a lot of them joined the British Union of Fascists. So they were attracted to these again, this is what we talked about earlier, borderline personality disorder. They were just attracted to these extreme things. Emmeline Pankhurst argued at a trial that 80% of English men had syphilis and would go mad. And in order to save the English race from destruction, women had to be allowed to take over England. Anyway, that aside, what the vote for women initially brought about was greater conservatism, because in that time, we lived in a conservative society, women were more religious than men, and so women were more inclined to vote for right-wing parties than men. And this flipped in the generation born in the 50s and 60s, because this is when the religious society broke down. If we want to think of a year, it was probably 1963. Sex came rather late for me in 1963, somewhere between the end of the Chatterley Band and the Beatles' first LP. And so, and Kennedy and all that. And so then women start to become more liberal than men, and now women are more inclined to vote for the left than men. If you want to restore order, then there has to be less female influence. I mean, think about the damage to children as well. When I was at school, at my infant school, it was 100% female. Okay, that's fair enough. What kind of man would want to work at an infant school other than a nonce? But at my junior school, it was only the two male teachers. And at my secondary school, okay, that was probably majority male. But this is decreasingly the case. Now about 60% even of secondary school teachers are women. And so it's turning schools into female spaces where you aren't encouraged to, like, what equality. You have these different these values, like harm avoidance and equality. Well, that's female values. And male values, authority and structure and loyalty and things like that. And that means you aspire for something, and it means that you see life as a struggle, which it is. And so I think women dominating education doesn't prepare people for life. And you just get these people that aren't properly brought up. I mean, I had a paper published recently on corporal punishment. We found that controlling for other factors like genetics and whatever, corporal punishment has positive outcomes. But the feminization of education means it's gone, no corporal punishment anymore. And so you have a generation now that no corporal punishment at school, no fear at school, basically, like we had in the 80s. I think the influence is ultimately, it's too much. It's too strong. It's destroying academia. It's destroying education. You're getting boys that aren't being taught to be boys, that are being taught it's bad to be a boy. You shouldn't be a boy. So they're going to become depressed and maladapted and develop suboptimally. And the only people that are going to be resistant to this this barrage of maladaptive environmental pressure are those that are strongly genetically resistant to it, i.e. the remnant normal population that would have survived, that would have been around in the 1600s or whatever, before Darwinian conditions broke down. And I think that's what quite a few of us are. We're the remnant normal population. And so what I suspect is going to happen is that eventually all those people that aren't the remnant normal population will die out. They'll just go pass on their genes. And what you'll be left with, and the data is consistent with this, is the people that we now call the far right. That's who's breeding. That's what predicts breeding. 100 years from now, that's who'll be left, or less than 100 years from now. And so things will change radically. But yeah, the influence of women is too. I mean, the one way you could check it would be the abolition of higher education for women. That's one thing that's been suggested. Or the limiting of it or something like that. I mean, like this thing Jill Biden with the PhD, you know, in education, it just undermines the value of it because it becomes woman's work. It's like being a secretary. And nobody cares.
Okay. Somebody has asked, you explained earlier about the psychology of people who have rape fantasies. Mm. Do you have any insight into the increasing prevalence of incest porn in society? Fucking hell.
There's been a couple of books on this. So there was one called A Billion Wicked Thoughts, and there was one that I did a video on. I can't remember what it is, but what the name of the video was. It was quite recently. I did a video that drew upon this book. What I would suspect is that what you get if you have no Darwinian, very limited Darwinian selection pressure, so lots of mutants. They will have maladaptive sexual desires that would have been selected out under harsh Darwinian conditions. And so people who would want to bang their brother or something, that those kind of people would be selected. And that people did. I mean, the Egyptians used to, Egyptian royalty, ancient Egyptian royalty used to have sex with their siblings. They would be selected out because of the consequences of that in terms of dysgenics. And you would expect therefore this to spread. Secondly, at the environmental level, you would traditionally have had a conservative religious system which would make all this taboo to the point of unthinkable. But now that has gone, and so you have free access to pornography and free access to, like, increasingly aberrant taboo or formerly taboo practices thing. And so once you've moved away from vanilla, and once you've got, you know, you can see how, if you're particularly into porn, let's go on to the next revolting thing and the next revolting. And eventually you need some. And there was research on this as well, that people that a lot of the Zoomer generation that have had access to porn all their lives, they can't get it up to vanilla porn. It's no good.
Yes, it has to get ever more extreme.
It has to get they're immune to that. It has to be extreme. Whereas if you go back to Victorian times, people could get it up because there was a bare ankle. Because they were so unused to nudity. And this is actually quite important. If you think that we have evolved, basically, we Westerners, to a society where people are covered up. And so when nudity is something, not perhaps the Finns, I mean, they're into sauna and stuff, but we British, perhaps, to a society where people are covered up. And so you would expect us to be easily aroused by nudity. Now, people that are fast life history strategists, of course, they're not evolved. They're evolved to a society where people are running, doing any aberrant stuff. And so they would be attracted to they'd need more and more extreme things. Nudity is not good enough. In these fast witchy societies, women walk around naked. Who cares? Nudity is. So you need more and more and more. And you eventually end up with more and more sick stuff. Incest porn would potentially be one. I mean, it should also be noted, there's something called the Westermark effect. It's Finnish anthropologist Edvard Westermark. And he found that if this kibbutzes have shown this, that if people are separated at birth, let's say twins, a brother and a sister or a father and a daughter, and they're not raised together in early life, then they will meet later and be deeply sexually attracted to each other, because we tend to be sexually attracted to genetic similarity. And so if someone's 50% the same as you and you haven't been brought up with them in early life, and then you meet them later, then you'll be very attracted to them. And this is a serious problem. So, that's how I would explain the rise of incest porn. And there's things that are much more. I mean, there's sex with animals.
Yeah, on that note, I remember reading about two people who met, and it turned out then they were very attracted to each other, and then it turned out that they were both from sperm donors. Their father, and they had the same father, so they were half siblings. And that
would make sense. Yeah. It would be profoundly, because the sweet spot is third cousin. There's research from Iceland, of course. There's only 300,000 people there, so everyone's related. And the sweet spot in terms of fertility and not getting divorced is third cousin. So the person you should marry is your third cousin or equivalent. So that is to say 1.5% above the baseline of the society in terms of how related you are. And it seems that's what slow life history strategists do, because you select people that are similar to you, because if you're similar to each other, you're going to get on better and you're going to indirectly pass on more of your genes and whatever. And so people who are slower life history strategists do tend to be attracted to people that are more genetically similar to themselves. That's true. But in extremis, you could see, if they didn't know they were brother and sister, you could see, of course, they're going to be attracted because they're 50% the same.
Right. Okay.
What?
Just the questions. All right. Why do some relatively inbred groups have high IQ? Icelanders and Ashkenazi Jews, for example.
Well, in the case of the Ashkenazi Jews, it can be argued that... So there's two ways of understanding this. You have inbreeding depression... which is that if you have a child with someone that's very similar to you, then there'll be double doses of harmful genes, and so that's bad. But there's also outbreeding depression, which is that if you have sex with someone that's very dissimilar to you, then genes which haven't combined, for alleles that haven't combined for a very long time, will combine, which in polygenic traits will have unpredictable results. So that's bad. But you could also have inbreeding vigor, which is that if you inbreed, then it will elevate positive traits, and you could have outbreeding vigor. And so there's no reason why it can't be the case. If you're a highly intelligent subgroup and you want to make, this is what you see with the Indian caste system, inbreeding vigor. So they make sure that someone is relatively similar to them, whom they marry, and they keep the highest castes highly intelligent and whatever. That's what they're doing, inbreeding vigor. If they didn't do it, then the men would just go for stupid but pretty women, and the women would go for, and the women might go for, you know, well-armed, you know, butch
idiots.
Yeah, what's that wrestler called? John Cena. People like him. So you know, that's the problem. So it can be positive, and that's what you have with the Ashkenazi Jews. The Ashkenazi Jews were pushed into a situation where they could only engage in certain professions. And this meant that if you weren't intelligent enough to engage in that profession, then you couldn't really marry out. And so you just die out and not pass on your genes. And so this heavily selected for intelligence. And it meant that if you marry other Ashkenazi Jews, rather than who is of your family or similar to you, you know, then you're ensuring as an intelligent person that you're marrying someone else that's intelligent. And so you get inbreeding vigor. The flip side of it can be, of course, certain genetic disorders being prevalent among them. And it's interestingly, there was a theory by Henry Harpending and somebody else that some of Tay-Sachs and some of these Jewish disorders are actually correlated with intelligence. So if you have one of the alleles, one of the mutant alleles, then you are very, very clever. If you have two, then you taste sacked. So the inbreeding vigor continues and it stays in the population. As for the Icelandic, I would say that you must remember that until relatively recently, cousin marriage was quite high. Parts of Sicily and whatever used to have in the 60s, even very high levels of cousin marriage. So marrying people that are quite similar to you. I mean, in Finland, for example, in England, we're all 12th cousins. So we English are all related if you go back about 500 years or 400 years. In Finland, you've only got to go back about 250 years, 300 years, and everyone's related. So even in Finland, you've got people that are perhaps without knowing it, marrying their third cousins and stuff like this. And with the Icelandic, it's just an extension of that. They run a very harsh levels of selection. And so you would expect very high levels of intelligence to be selected for. And that's what's happened. And so it is a problem, though. There is actually an app in Iceland where you can type in the name of this boy or girl you want to go out with and you can see how related you are. Because they're all at least, they're all like no less than fifth cousins. They're all highly related. And most of them are the same, marry their third cousin.
All right. Somebody asks, what mating strategy should incels adopt? And that's from someone calling himself Patrick Bateman.
It depends. I get the impression that what incels are failed fast life history strategists. So they want to have lots of sex and be promiscuous and stuff like that and not commit. That's what they want to do, and they can't. Because in a situation where women are liberated and where women have power and control, then the women will just go for the alpha males and the beta males won't get, the women that are sluts, I mean, will just go for the alpha males and the beta males won't get much of a look in. So what I would suspect the incels need to do is to go for the slower life history strategy females and be content with monogamy. And then at least they won't be celibate. But I don't think that's what they want. I think that I get the impression they want to compete to be alpha males. So that's that.
So it's kind of all or nothing for them.
Yeah.
Perhaps. Okay. Someone asks, Ed, you previously mentioned the Irish score higher in extroversion. Which European ethnic group scores highest in introversion?
We can't. It's very hard to have exact measures of this because if you give somebody a personality test, then they will compare themselves to people they know, and so you end up with this insane situation where if you compare international averages on personality tests, Nigerians are higher in conscientiousness than the like Japanese, which is insane. So you can't use personality tests. You can use them within a nation, but you can't use them between nations. So based on proxies, it's as far as I can see, it's the Finns. The Finns are the lowest in extroversion based on various proxies.
Well, they're famously unsocial, aren't they? There's a sort of national joke about that they like to keep to themselves.
Yeah, a pissed Finn behaves kind of like me or you are behaving now.
All right. So in a related to that, the same person asks, are there any measurable trait differences between Eastern and Western Europeans?
Well, if we regard the Finns as Eastern Europeans, then yes, they are lower in extroversion. There is a so-called J curve of alcoholism, which goes across north down through Eastern Europe, and they tend to be more the sort of Finno-Ugric type peoples. This includes the Hungarians and even people in Slovenia, and they tend to be more prone to suicide. If in contact with alcohol, particularly suicide and depression and things like this. Latvia Estonia, Hungary, Slovenia. So that's a known difference for some Eastern European groups, that there's this propensity to alcoholism and that it associates with suicidality and depression and things like that. So that's a known difference.
All right. Here's a very good question. Is it psychologically healthier to be a jack of all trades or a specialist?
Psychologically healthier. So you mean...
Well, there's more to that. I should read that, the whole thing. How does it affect the dynamic between insectoid European people and all-rounder non-European people? I don't know, but let's concentrate on the first bit. Is it psychologically healthier to be a jack of all trades or a specialist?
Well, you will tend to have psychological health if you are in, if you are of high status within your group. This makes people happy and undepressed and whatever if they feel that they're reasonably successful. And in Western societies, normally the way you become successful is by being a specialist. That's how you become successful. You specialize and you find a niche. But on the other hand, those that have a sort of easy attitude to life, that just live for the now and don't care and are happy anyway, those people won't tend to work hard. They won't tend to specialize, and they'll be quite content to be a generalist that switches jobs, and they won't worry. So, but I think that in general, people are happier if they have high status, and it is specializing in a Western society that gives you high status. So that's the first thing. Specializing is more important the more complex the society is. So if it is a complex society like ours, it's much more important to specialize, and it will be much more important the social status that you specialize, that you find a niche. Whereas in more easier societies, everyone does the same sort of job, but whatever. There's less of a need to specialize.
So it's what it's conducive towards social status.
It's conducive towards social status to specialize. People want social status, and so people in that, and that's associated with, if you're saying, contentedness. The other thing that's associated with contentedness is an evolutionary match. So if you had an evolutionary mismatch, an elephant living in a cold place or whatever, you will be unhappy. And that's why we're increasingly unhappy in the West, because we're in an evolutionary mismatch. We're not supposed to live like this. We're meant to live in small communities where we know everybody and they're all genetically similar to us. That's what makes us happy. That's what we want.
Right.
And so that we're in an evolutionary mismatch. Immigration, people different. That is an extreme evolutionary mismatch. Being surrounded by ugly buildings is an evolutionary mismatch. Lack of religiosity, evolutionary mismatch. So if you are the kind of person that is a sort of fast life history strategist or whatever, or a happy-go-lucky type, and you're sort of lazy or something, your evolutionary match may well be to be a generalist, and you will be unhappy if you are compelled to be a specialist. So it depends on the kind of person you are. Maybe your evolutionary match is to be a generalist.
Right.
So there's different dynamics to the question.
Okay. It's impossible to answer the question, really, because it varies from one individual to the next.
Yeah.
Okay. It's one thing to prove that women are a negative influence when empowered in society, but quite another to offer a solution. Do you have any suggestions about how we can push back female influence? That is quite another thing indeed. And I don't think it's fair to ask the person who diagnoses the problem to also have a solution to it. But Ed, is there anything you would want to say about this?
Well, to the extent that you can do anything, you need the promotion of a more conservative society. And and once that starts to happen, then you can more rationally present the evidence. And it is true that women are happier, and they are happier because it's an evolutionary mismatch. Remember, that's what makes you unhappy. The evolutionary match for most women is to be what they've always been. That's what they're happiest being. They're happier. And they show this. If you look at the research by Joanna Williams on this, they show this, even if they get jobs. They want to retire early. They want to have a work-life balance. They want to, you know, spend ages off work and be with the kids. That's what they want to do. To the extent they go into jobs, they go into jobs where they're caring about people and looking after people and basically doing the kind of jobs which they always did, even when they could work. It's just that now they're teaching boys and girls, whereas historically they'd just be teaching girls. And that's what they do. That's what they want to do. That's what makes them happy. And you might get a few. And that's interesting that when they have a real choice, which they do in very feminist type society like ours, that's
like
what they
Sweden.
Do. Right. Yeah. Whereas in Italy or whatever, where there's less choice, they feel more of a pressure, because they need to make money or something. They feel more of a pressure to go into the sciences, which they don't like doing and they're not very good at. And they ruin when they do go into it because they don't like the kind of person that will come up with brilliant and original ideas. Is the kind of person that will be autistic and is therefore the kind of person that will make inappropriate jokes and offend people like Alexander Strumio, who I'm going to have on my show next year, and whatever. And they'll drive those people out, as they tried to do with him. And so, it's bad for society that women... We talk about, how can we encourage more women to go into STEM subjects? No, how can we encourage women to not go into STEM subjects? How can we encourage women to not go into STEM subjects?
Okay. Which European nation has the optimal level of in-group preference? Not too high, leading to a backward or violent society. Not too low, where they'll be taken advantage of by hostile out-groups.
By the way, I don't. I'm perfectly happy for women to be involved in STEM subjects of a certain kind. Probably religious women, actually. It's interesting, Margaret Thatcher went into STEM subjects. Highly religious, patriarchal, conservative women go into STEM subjects and invent ice cream. Interesting. With regard to that question, probably one of the Eastern European nations. It's hard to say which, because the Eastern Europe is going the way of Western Europe very slowly. There's some evidence. It is a backlash as well happening, as there's some very base stuff happening in Poland and Hungary and whatever. But it is also... I think it'll polarise very strongly. I think that's what's happening. But it'll polarise. We are polarising now in a situation where the left are culturally in power and the right are not. And there's this polarisation, and it's increasingly obvious. And eventually, I think it will result in a tip back towards the right. It may be that the Eastern Europe polarises with the right in power and the left not. I don't know what's going to happen. But one of those kind of countries probably has the optimum balance somewhere like, I would have said Finland, 15 years ago, but now Finland has fallen to the spite girls. But probably one of those kind of countries, Hungary or someone like that.
Okay. Professor Dutton, please consider Dr. Andrew Joyce, Dr. MacDonald, or Dr. Johnson on one of your future shows.
Well, I've had Kevin MacDonald on my show twice. I don't know how many other more times I can you'll find that show on BitChute, or two of them, both those shows on BitChute. And who are the others?
Dr. Andrew Joyce and Dr. Greg Johnson.
Andrew Joyce and Greg Johnson, right? Okay.
Okay. And someone else asks: are people from the British Isles predisposed to violent behaviour? When I'm in mainland Europe, I don't see half as many fights as I do in England.
Possibly. I can think of two things. First of all, we industrialised earlier. And so if we industrialised earlier than anybody else, we're going to be more dysgenic than everybody else. And also we were a reasonably large population anyway. But so we're more dysgenic, and all of the religious people left went to America. And so what you're going to end up with is just the violent scum. I mean, that's quite possible, actually. But we would be more dysgenic. We would be more dysgenic. That's possible. Secondly, that we are a temperance culture. So this is something to do with being in the north and also coming to farming relatively late by European standards. So once you get farming, then you get the development of alcohol. Once you get the development of alcohol, it's adaptive to be able to drink alcohol and not get drunk or not get an alcoholic or whatever, because then you don't have to drink the water. And as you get a more complex society, the water's going to be dirty and whatever. And so as farming spreads, the genes to be resistant to alcoholism spread. Now, alcoholism was found, farming was founded in the Fertile Crescent 10,000 years ago. And so we've had the Spanish and the Greeks and the Italians and the Southern Europeans have had much longer for the genes to spread. So therefore they're completely resistant to alcohol. They don't particularly like it. They don't drink it much. They drink it only with meals. They have very low levels of alcoholism. And when they go out on a Friday night, they get dressed up in nice clothes and go out on Vespers and talk very loudly in cafes. That's their Friday night. Whereas our Friday night, because we are less resistant to alcohol, there's a critical mass of people that are very attracted to alcohol and get drunk and whatever and very easily and become alcoholics and whatever and become violent. And that may well be the reason for the difference.
All right. One last question. The genetic basis of your claim of today's pervasiveness of witches is underpinned by the hypothesis that mutations leading to infant mortality also affect pro or antisocial behavior.
Mm. Not really.
Is there, yes. And he said, is there evidence for that?
Well, there's evidence of there's evidence that with the collapse of the infant mortality is the crucible of evolution. There's a paper on that called Infant Mortality, something like it's by it's called the Crucible of Evolution, and looks at this. And so there is certainly evidence of a rise in mutational load. There is evidence that physical mutations are correlated with antisocial mental problems like schizophrenia, depression, autism, whatever, and violence, psychopathology. It correlates with these mutations. So, in that sense, yes, there is evidence for that. So the physical mutation correlates with mental mutation, and mental mutation in a maladaptive antisocial direction. One thing I'd add, actually, about transsexuality. Being a transsexual correlates with hereditary deafness and all kinds of other things as well. Crohn's disease, asthma, whatever. Now, you could put some of these things down to stress of being a transsexual or something, but I can't see how you could put deafness down to it. Curvature of the spine. I was at university with this guy, Alex, who then became Drea. And then worked as a prostitute in Brighton and was murdered by a Scottish Sky television fitter who he told he used to be a man. And I probably told you that story. But he had some kind of appalling series of problems that they had to like operate on his anus and things like this. So, like all these hereditary mutations, and that would be consistent with narcissism. All these physical problems are correlate with narcissism, with mental problems that are antisocial.
It's not the kind of thing you want to hear about while you're fitting someone's Sky television box.
Well, no, he went there. He was a Sky fitter who went there to fit Alex's box, and then I get the impression that Alex must have said he must have said something like, "Oh, you have very nice weave." We breasties, don't you? You have very nice breasts. They're very perfect. And then Alex would have said, "Oh well, yeah, they would be really nice because I was born a man, and so they're fake." And then he saw red and strangled him.
Bloody hell! Okay, that's a very strange story. All right. Okay, so that's that question. And then we've just got the diamonds on DLive. Someone says, "Good to see Dr. Dutton on DLive. Thanks as always." And someone else said, "Hail Bose, hail Ed, hail Scrubs." I'm not really sure what the term Scrubs refers to, but I've heard it's associated with Dangerfield and so on. So, all right. Well, excellent. This has been a very interesting stream. I hope that people have enjoyed it. So would you like to summarize, just before we finish, could you summarize the theory about witches and antisocial behavior and the fall of civilization again, just so that we can end the stream on a summary of that theory.
So the Summoning Theory is that what witches are, in evolutionary terms, is people who undermined patriarchy, the patriarchal system in various ways. And that was bad because at the group selection level, patriarchy was associated with maintaining positive and negative ethnocentrism and maintaining religiousness, which is all associated with winning in the battle of group selection. So that's what these witches are doing. They were undermining patriarchy. And that's what modern-day witches do. They undermine patriarchy. And so it's the same. They're functionally the same. And so we must understand that we are living in a society that is dominated by literal witches, and that is not good. And as I say, the book should be coming out later this year, Witches, Feminism, and the Fall of the West.
You mean next year, 2021?
Sorry, next year. Yeah, I should plug my channel, shouldn't I? Jolly Heretic, online public house, live stream Mondays and Thursdays, 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, and various books you can get if you look into it. So, yeah, that's it.
All right. Well, excellent. Well, thank you, Professor Edward Dutton, the Jolly Heretic, for taking part in Millennial 2020.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, I'll be back in 15 minutes with John Bruce Leonard. In the meantime, hope you enjoyed this. Thank you to everyone for watching, and I'll see you later. Bye for now.